everybody, I'm Kitty, I'm an alcoholic. Cindy gave me $20 to tell you all that she's an exemplary member of AA. No, I'm just kidding, but I've had the honor and privilege of picking up Cindy from the airport and hanging out with her today, and she's really cool and seems like an alcoholic of the hopeless variety who's... Well, we can relate. That's how I know. I'm like, oh, yeah, she's one of me, and I'm one of her. So I think we're all in for a treat tonight, so without further ado, here's Cindy.
My name is Cindy Masters. I'm an alcoholic. Because of the grace of God, some simple actions in this program, and both sides of sponsorship, I've been sober since December the 17th, 1985. And for that, I'm very grateful. And the truth is, that's the biggest deal in my life today. I have a big life, and there are a lot of things that a lot of people would perceive as big deals in my life. But the reason I have a big life and the reason that there are big deals in my life is because every day in a row for what will be next week, if I stay sober, 24 years, AA and God have come first. And as long as that's the deal, I get to not take a drink. And as long as I don't take a drink, everything else is possible no matter what happens. No matter who loves me, leaves me, or dies. I get to not drink, and the whole world is full of the same possibilities for me that are possibilities for people that are alcoholic. It doesn't mean that I used to hear people behind the podium, I'd hear them say, you get sober and you get your family back and you get a house and you get money and you get cars and you get stuff. And that's not what we say at all. What we say is that if you don't drink and you work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and you learn how to give back to other people, that you'll learn that you'll get a sense of purpose about your life and you'll get to feel true happiness and true joy. That's what we promise. And that's a lot better than a new car. Sometimes you get that too. But I originally got to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1980, although my sobriety date is 1985. And I was 17 years old, which is why that I'm probably talking to a young people's group. I'm old now. But I was not old then. And I'll tell you what, back then everybody in AA was old, I'll tell you that. I will tell you that. When I started drinking, I was about this big. And I drank for the reason it talks about in the textbook of Alcoholics Anonymous. I drank for the effect produced by alcohol. I hear people get up here and they say, well, it made me feel glamorous. And it made me feel beautiful. And it made me feel tall. Well, it didn't do none of that for me, all right? What drinking did for me, see, I felt real sorry for myself. I've been feeling sorry for myself my whole life. I felt like a victim. I was given up for birth when I was a baby, and then I got put in this house with these people that cared about me as much as they could, but there were some problems, and Children's Services pulled me out of that house, and I wound up in a lot of institutions and stuff, and I blamed the world for me, and I just got mad, and I was just angry, and what happened when I drinks is I didn't care. See, drinking helped me not care. It let it not matter. And so to save on time, by the time I was 17 years old, I've been in over 25 institutions. I hitchhiked from one end of this country to the other. I either lived in the streets or an institution or some kind of foster home. And that's what my life looked like. I was very angry. There were probably some of those places that tried to help me, but I was so angry. See, I had that alcoholic anger. You know what I'm talking about? Like, it becomes like this rageful thing, and it's like, you can't show me, and you can't tell me, because it hasn't been fair, and it has to be this way to help me. You know what I mean? I could tell you how you could help me. But if you wanted to help me any other way but the way that I was painting for you to help me, you could not help me. So therefore, nobody could help me because nobody was willing to do it the way that I told them to. Isn't that funny? So when I was 17 years old, I was living in Washington, D.C. I did all the things that you do when you live out on the streets. I didn't go to high school. When you live on the streets and you live the way that I lived, you don't just not graduate, you don't go. It's impossible to live on the streets and go to school. It doesn't happen. And so you can't drink round the clock and go to school. So I didn't have any education. By the time I was 17 years old, I didn't have a hope. I didn't have a dream. I didn't have nothing I was going to grow up and be. I just wanted my life to be done. I wanted it to be over. Everything about me hurt. And the only time I didn't hurt was when I drank. And I felt like drinking was my solution. What drinking did was it helped me not hurt so much. So I was living in Washington, D.C., and the only thing I cared about at all anymore was I had this foster brother and sister that had had muscular dystrophy, and they were the only place I ever lived where people had it worse than me. You know, my foster brother and sister, they never walked, and they never could feed themselves, and they couldn't give themselves a bath. And I learned two things when I lived in that house. I learned that somebody had it worse than me, and that I wasn't the very worst in the world. And I learned also the feeling that you get when you're useful to another human being. Because I got to help put them in bed. And I got to help turn them in bed at night because they couldn't turn themselves. They'd have to holler out for somebody to turn them because they didn't have the muscle strength to turn themselves at night. And I got to do that. And I felt like that was my honor to get to do. And the only deal I had in that foster home was I wasn't allowed to drink before they went to bed. And I couldn't keep that commitment because alcoholism already had the best of me. But I cared about him. My foster brother was having surgery. We didn't think that he'd make it through. I hitchhiked back from Washington, D.C. to Cincinnati, which was where I grew up. And my foster brother survived that surgery, and I did the same thing I would have done whether he survived or whether he didn't survive. You see, he survived it, so I called it celebrating. And if he didn't survive it, I would have called it grieving. But I drank. Because, see, that's what I did. That's all I knew to do. I was a garbage can. I would do anything out there. But what makes me an alcoholic is that when I drink, I get what's called the phenomenon of craving. Which isn't that a fancy word. Phenomenon. You know? That word has more syllables than my whole vocabulary had words when I got here. You know? And I'm not kidding about that. You know? And all phenomenon of craving means, because when I got here and I run across stuff like that in the big book, I'd say, too fancy for me. Must not apply. And all that really means is just that when I drink, I get a big craving that makes me want more. It means that even if I was planning on coming to your wedding today, I start drinking, all of a sudden I think, well, maybe I'll just show up for the reception. You know, because now I'm drinking. I'm busy. And drinking just, and I don't think but as, oh, I got a phenomenon of craving. I think I'll skip the wedding. You know, that's not, it doesn't register in my mind as a phenomenon of craving. You know, it's just that I'm busy. You know, drinking makes me very busy. And, you know what I mean? And so, I'm way too busy to do a lot of other things. So anyway, he survived. I drank, and I'm a blackout drinker. I'm disgusting, but I black out, and I woke up in University Hospital in Cincinnati. I'm hanging on a wall, and I'm all tied up, and when I look down, I'm black and blue from my chin to my knees, and I'm mad. I'm like, who did this to me? And this nurse said, you did. And I didn't like that. And she said, you're an alcoholic. And I didn't like that either. And then she told me that the county sheriff was on his way. I wasn't going to juvenile, even though I was just barely 3 months, 17 years old. She said I was going to county jail and that I had a number of felonies. And here's what ended up happening that night that I didn't remember. See, blackout drinking, for those of you that maybe don't blackout, what that means is I could be in the middle of a conversation and come to and have to catch up. And as a female, it's a very scary thing to be a blackout drinker because you can wake up in very compromised positions and not know if you volunteered or not. And it's frightening. And so anyway, what happened that night, according to some other people, was that I used to carry a gun. And I carried a gun because I was kind of afraid. You know, most, think about it. Why do you need to carry a gun if you're not afraid? There's no reason to carry a gun if you're not afraid. You don't need one. But I would carry a gun. I didn't have a voice back then. It's hard to imagine now because I got such a big mouth now. But, you know, it's like people didn't listen real good. And so when they didn't listen real good, I found that if I brought my gun out, they paid a lot better attention. Now, I had a good heart. You know what I mean? I just wanted to be heard. And apparently my friend walked into a retail store and I went in trying to continue a conversation that she didn't want to have. I didn't want to take anything. I just wanted to have a conversation. I think this is what the big book's talking about. While we're judging ourselves by our intentions, the rest of the world continues to judge us by our actions. Apparently, if you go into a retail store with a gun all toasted up, that's a very bad thing. When the police come, it gets worse. And, you know, you can imagine how that night turned out, right? So they take me to county jail, and the only good news is that I go into withdrawal. I'm all malnourished. Hard to imagine now. That hurt my feelings. But not really. I know the truth. Anyway, I was all malnourished, and so they sent me to a treatment center out in Brown County, Ohio, and for 2 weeks they put me in whirlpool baths and stuff. I didn't have to do nothing but just be getting better, shoot me up with B12 and whatever else they shot you up with back in those days. And then they said it was time to go to an A of A meeting. I said, an A of A meeting? Are you crazy? See, I was a street warrior. I was bad to the bone. I was a drug addict. See, I was a garbage can. I did a lot of things. I thought it was cool to be a drug addict. You know what I mean? It was the only thing I had any success at in my life. And being an alcoholic, that wasn't so cool. And if I was an alcoholic, I wasn't going to be allowed to drink. Besides that, my foster mama told me I was an alcoholic, and she told me never go to those A of A meetings. They make you believe in God. And so I was not going to go to an A of A meeting. No. They said that I had to either go to the A of A meeting or I had to go back to jail. You know, only for us is that a hard choice. I think if you ask any normal person, would you like to go to AA or jail? They pick AA right in a heartbeat. Not me, I had to think about it. Well, I went to their A of A meeting, and it was all men. See, back then, it was different. There weren't as many women, and there weren't so many young people. It was mostly men in their 50s and 60s, real frickin' old, okay? And there was one guy that was 35, and when you're 17, 35 is old. It's double. You know, it's double 17. That's old. So I didn't relate to none of them. There's a guy in there that got a DUI on a tractor, and you know, I didn't identify with that. Now, here's what I do identify with. Here's why he got caught. And this is just like me. He's going down the highway and he's drunk and in a blackout. He forgot where he was, so he put the plow down. See, that's what I do. That's what I do. So I was a punk in treatment. You've seen me before. I use profanity to keep you away. See, I use profanity when I am afraid. And I use profanity like a shield. And I use words those little old country farmers had never heard. You know, I'm telling you, you know, because I was from D.C. Now, I don't know what part of D.C. I've lived a few places, but mostly they've been on the streets and usually with whatever man was putting me up and taking care of me. You know what I mean? And it's like, but they'd never seen anybody from any big city. And so I played it up. And I'd cuss at them. And I was like a little circus animal or something. And you know what they did? They were nice to me. You know what they did? They practiced the AA code that's laid out in the 10th step in the big book called love and tolerance. And they were loving and they were tolerant. We forget that a lot of times in AA. We get so rigid and structured that we forget that our code is to be loving and tolerant, inclusive, never exclusive, always inclusive, always loving, always tolerant. And those old men and their wives loved me into AA. And I don't know that we always extend that same loving hand. I hope we do. They told me, they said, Cindy, you just worked those 12 steps and your life can be different. And here's what I told them. I said, and I believe this with all of my being. See, when I talk about institutions, I'm not talking about these Holiday Inn psych units that people call institutions. Okay? Honest to God, that's better than the hotel you guys had me stay in. But when I was in institutions, I was in the state mental hospital in the 70s, where terrible things happened, where it was gross and disgusting. I'm talking about disgusting, disgusting institutions. And I had many labels, lots of different ones. Take your pick, roll of, you know, I had about every label that you could have. And I told him, I said, you don't understand. I'm broken. You see, I'm broken. I'm broken beyond repair. I wish that your steps would work for me, but I'm broken. And they won't. And I was so afraid to try working the steps, because I thought, if I try these steps and they don't work, I've just proved everybody that's put me away my whole life right. I've just proved them all right. And I was too afraid to try. And I got out of there, and I went to meetings. I went to the clubhouse, Oak Street, And the reason, boys, why they tell you to stay away from us when you're new is, and when we're new, is not necessarily for us girls. It's to protect yourselves. I'm not kidding. I, 'cause you're easy when you're new. You're vulnerable. And so I went to Oak Street and I met a couple of you and I took you out drinking because it seemed like the logical thing to do. And when I drink, I get a sense of entitlement. Because, see, those people, they grew up in a way that I didn't. And they have things I never had. And why should they, just because they were born into a certain household, have those things and I don't? Doesn't make sense to me. So I drink and I decide I should have them. So I went and I had hardwood floors and I got these guys in AA to help me go borrow some carpet from a model home. And here's where I get above the rules. I decided that we should do it in broad daylight. Because after all, if we do it in broad daylight, people will think we belong there. And you see, this is my magnificent magnifying mind that's described in our literature. I always get caught. Are you surprised? And that's the good news. This was a county I'd not been caught in before. I got tried as a juvenile. I was still 17. I'd stayed sober about 6 months on loving AA. But loving AA is not enough to stay sober. Loving AA is enough to want to be in AA. I didn't feel like I deserved to be in AA. I hadn't conceded to my innermost self that I was alcoholic. I hadn't had anybody explain about the phenomenon of craving. Nobody had explained to me and really gone through the first step with me. Everybody just whizzed through it like it was just a check mark. You know, nobody had really taken the time to sit one-on-one with me. And I'm sure that I wouldn't allow anybody to. You know, but I didn't feel like I deserved my seat in AA. And if you don't feel like you deserve your seat in AA, please stay. Please stay. And anyway, I got a probation officer who had been a 10-year detox nurse before. And she knew that I loved Alcoholics Anonymous, but didn't feel like I deserved to be here. See, I was one of those people, like when people come to AA and they say, I can't believe I have to be with these people. These drunks. That was not me. I came to AA and I couldn't believe that you let me be with you. I couldn't believe that you let me go to coffee with you. I couldn't believe you bought me coffee and pie. I couldn't believe it. I hadn't fit in anywhere unless I was sleeping with you. You know, unless I was sleeping with you, there was nowhere that I fit. And there was nowhere that I belonged. And so this was pretty special for me. You know, even when I cussed at you, you didn't tell me to go away. You said, come on back. You know, even when I was a jackass, you said, come on back. You just loved me. I'm so grateful for that because you saved my life. She sent me to a halfway house in Lexington, Kentucky. At that time, it was the only halfway house for women in a three-state area. This was in 1981, January of 1981. And she made me become an emancipated adult. I've been living like an adult for a long time. It was time to be one. And so I went to that, and I learned some things. I got a sponsor, and I worked the steps to the best of my ability, and I got a higher power that I could live with. And I got a little job, and I bought my own coffee after meetings. And you know what I did? I got a home group, and I started making coffee at that home group. See, I didn't know how to talk to people. And when I made coffee and I handed you coffee, I learned how to talk to you, and you remembered my name. And when I had that little job, I started putting a dollar in the basket. And I started getting there early and helping set up and staying late and helping clean up. And you know what happened? You all started to know me. And you know what happened? I believed that I belonged. I belonged because I participated. See, I didn't understand that. I wanted to feel right about everything before I acted right. I wanted to feel like I belonged before I started participating. And what I didn't know was that it took the participating to feel like I belonged. It's like I wanted, all my life I'd seen all these shrinks and all these psychologists. You know, I'd had all these names that people called me. And I thought, I'm just not getting the right shrink. You know, if I could just get the right shrink and they would explain it to me, like how these other people that are grow up the right way, they get this thing that tells them how to live this deal. And if I could just get that, then I would know how to live. And when I knew how to live, then I would feel some self-esteem and some pride. And then I would be able to act like those people act. And what I didn't understand was that it was when I started to not have men, not manipulate men to buy my coffee after the meeting, but bought my own coffee. That's when I started to have a little self-esteem and my shoulders started to go back. That's when my head started to go up. That's when I started to like myself. That's when I started to feel a sense of self-esteem and a sense of pride because I took right action and I began to feel right. And you could tell me that till the cows came home, but I'm not going to believe it until I actually do it. And it took having a sponsor that I trusted enough to take small actions with that went early to the meeting to set up with me, that was making coffee with me, that stayed late and helped clean up with me, you know, so that I had somebody there with me. And I'm very grateful for the good sponsorship that I've had in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got sober in Cincinnati in Young People's, the largest Young People's group I think that's ever been in this country. It was 350 members large till about 1986. And it was strong. But anyway, the next thing that happened was they told me I needed to go. They said I was doing so good. They said, Cindy, you need to go take classes for your GED. And it scared me because I thought, you know, I knew I was street smart, but I was afraid that I was dumb. And I think that anybody that lives on the streets probably is afraid of that. That if you don't have an education, it's like, you know, you're afraid to test it out. I was afraid to test it out. So you had to go take these pretests to see where you would start in the classes. I went to the pretests, and even though I'd never been to high school, they said I didn't need to take the classes. They said, just take the test. And I took the test, and I scored in the top 2% of the country, which was kind of amazing. And you know what happened? I walked like this, man. I was like, I'm a high school. It was before, if I would have stayed in high school, it was before my high school class would have graduated. I was like, Yeah. And I started to speak with a lot more words. You know what I mean? It's like I started trying not to cuss. And the first word I lost from my vocabulary as much as I could was the F word. And then, you know what I mean? I just tried. You know, and it's like, and that's what it takes. It's like those of us that really try. And I can't say that I don't ever say it now, because once in a while, there it is, you know? Sometimes no other word will do, but but so I went back to Cincinnati, and I was AA Wonder Girl, because these people would see me come in, and they'd see me come in so rough. Now it's 1982, you know, and I'm going to a meeting every day, and I got a job, and I'm going to college. Cindy Masters is going to college, you know, and people love me. I'm giving talks everywhere, and, you know, it's like, yeah, look at me. I'm Sandra D, and, you know, I mean, it's on, and then I don't know about you, but I don't just have a committee. I got a firing squad. Boom! You know? And what mine sounds like is, if they knew you, they wouldn't think it. You're full of shit. You've tricked them. You're really a piece of crap. If they really knew it. And I go to bed, and this goes on and on and on and on. You know, it's like, if they really knew who you are, and just this is what happens. I don't get sleep anymore. All of a sudden, I got no peace. See, AA gave me peace, and all of a sudden, I got no peace because my mind's busy. Well, I got a couple choices when my mind gets busy like this. I can shoot myself in the head, and that might shut it up. Or I might live like that for eternity. I can drink, but at the end of my drinking, it still went on drunk. Or I can try this new thing that they talked about called amends. See, because here's what's going on. When I lived in that foster home, I did a fundraiser for MDA, and I raised quite a bit of money. And I took that money, and I tried to invest it, and the only thing I knew to invest money in, and it went wrong. And I lied to MDA and told them that the fundraiser never made money. And so, see, I don't think that we are insensitive people. I think we're hypersensitive people. See, when I do something wrong, it eats my lunch. I hate myself. And this cycle I get in when I'm drinking is I hate myself when I got a drink. And I drink and I do more terrible things. And I hate myself more and I got to drink more. And it just goes on and on and on. And so when I get sober, I got to go to MDA and I got to tell them what I did. And so I go to MDA and I say, look, I stole from you. And here's what happened. I didn't mean to steal from you, but here's what happened. I made money with that fundraiser. It was a couple thousand dollars. I'm paying it back. Is there anything else I can do to make this right? And here's what the lady said. She said, you can do a fundraiser for us. Crazy. So I did. Long story short, it went well. They had a weird freak opening, job opening, and I got offered the job of district director for the Muscular Dystrophy Association for their outlying counties in the greater Cincinnati area. I was 20 years old. I was 2 years sober. I was 2 years off the streets. I quit college. I was so glad to quit college. College is not for everybody. I hate college, okay? Can you jump through this hoop and hire through this one? I can't do it. I am just not built for college, you know? So I took this job. I was the only person he had ever hired without a college degree, all right? And I take this job. I got to put on the Jerry Lewis Labor Day telethon, the satellite for Cincinnati, all right? I'm going to Las Vegas to Caesar's Palace. I'm not even old enough to go in Caesar's Palace, and I'm going there to meet Jerry Lewis and to learn how to do it, all right? Now I'm flying. I've never flown. I've only hitchhiked, and you know, and now I'm giving talks everywhere. Now the first thing I did was I went and I bought a fuchsia suit, a skirt suit, and I bought person shoes that matched, and they gave me a business card, Cynthia R. Masters, District Director, Muscular Dystrophy Association. I had like a purple neon shirt that went with this. See, I didn't know how to dress. I came from the streets. I would look in a magazine and take a guess. You could see me at 100 yards, right? And I'm giving talks, and I'm one of those people behind the podium. I'm telling you, girls, if you work the 12 steps, you too can have a person shoes that match, you know? And you can have a secretary and a business card and all these nice things. And that's what I'm telling you. And see, I'm lost. I've lost it, you know, and I'm giving leads all over the place. And long story short is that I took a job that I didn't want. I took a job that I couldn't do because my ego said yes. Because I've got to be more to be enough. Because see, I've never just been enough. See, I got to be a little bit more than you to be enough to be just as good as you. Not to be better than you. I've got to have a little better car. I got to have a little more money, a little better job, live in a little better neighborhood, do a little bit better, do a little bit more 12-step work, have a few more sponsees. You know, I got to just do a little bit more so that I'm as good as you. It's not to be better than you. That is my egomania with an inferiority complex. So I've taken this job that I feel so afraid in, that I don't know what to do with the secretary. I'm fresh off the streets. I didn't go to high school. What am I doing being an executive director of a nonprofit organization? I'm hiding under my desk, hoping my secretary can't find me, you know? But I'm coming to AA meetings, and I'm telling you, look how great I am. Look how great I am. Aren't you proud of me? You stay sober in AA, you too can be an executive director. Oh, yes. Well, see, that's living a double life sober. I lost my capacity to be honest in AA. I lost my ability to be transparent. See, in AA, I must be transparent. I must be me everywhere. I can't be my AA me with you, my job me with you, my family me with you, and my so-and-so me with you. I have to be all of me with all of you, or I drink. It talks about it in the fifth step. Only it talks about us doing it while we drink. Why did it sober? And I got so filled with self-hatred. I drank going to meetings. I drank attending Alcoholics Anonymous. Because the only thing required completely, no matter what, is I must have a capacity to be honest. And I don't remember taking a drink. I woke up drunk. And my first thought was I was glad I didn't have to go back to that job. Because I wasn't ready for that job. But I didn't have the humility to say I wasn't ready. I liked being a dishwasher at Ponderosa. I did. I understood that job. I knew how to win at that job. You just do the dishes and they get done. You know what I mean? But like this executive director thing was beyond me. I just talk good. I'm in AA. We all talk good, you know? And but I didn't trust that you would love me. See, I didn't trust. I didn't trust that I was lovable unless I did something to be lovable. That's been my problem. And then I thought I would come right back to AA because I loved AA. This is the only good thing ever happened to me. And this terrible thing happened. That phenomenon of craving kicked in. And I would come to AA meetings and I would leave and I would have to go to the liquor store. You see, I lost the power of choice in drink once I picked one up. And it went on for almost a year, me trying to come back to AA. Towards the end of the year, I tried to come back less frequently. And that's something we don't think about, because I think especially in young people's, we watch a lot of people come and go, and they come back. But sometimes we lose our ability to come back. What happened on December 16th, 1985 was that I sat in front of my house crying because I couldn't find my home. I vomited on myself. It's not pretty when I drink. And I'm looking at my house straight away, crying because I can't find it, waking up out of a blackout, afraid about where I might be. That's pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. And some things changed. One thing I said the next morning was, God help me. And I don't know that I'd said that the whole year. And I don't think that I've ever said, God help me, and not been helped. I don't know that whether I even believed in God when I said it, but God help me. And I came back to AA very different. I came back with a level of humility that I had never known. And what humility means to me is to be teachable and to be willing to do it someone else's way. And for me, you know, I was worried about being smart. I happened to have been pretty darn smart. I had almost a photographic memory. I read the big book and memorized it. And I would go to meetings when I was early on and find old-timers that misquoted it. And I would go, boom! Oh, no, Mr. Old-timer, you are wrong. Page 34, paragraph 2, line 3 does not say that. So I was very popular with them, as you can only imagine. And, see, I couldn't see the forest for the trees. I knew everything it said, but very little of how to apply it and what it meant. And so the first thing my sponsor said is, Cindy Masters, you may not quote the big book. You may only paraphrase as it applies in your life. I had no idea what she meant. So for me to be willing to, I also like have studied the history of AA, the Oxford Group, the Washingtonians, da 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 da, because we used to compete in young people's who had the most knowledge. Knowledge won't keep us sober, but I it was very hard to have a sponsor that didn't know as much as I did, but who knew a lot more than I did about how to live sober, how to have relationships sober, how to have intimacy sober, you know, how to have a job sober, how to do life sober. And so I went on, and of course, you know, I am a step person. I believe in the steps. I believe that is our program of recovery. And I've worked the steps, and I take women through the steps, and I have a big book study in my house on Wednesday nights. And it's not just with the women I sponsor. It's with any woman that wants to come, but once you start, it's asked that you finish until we get finished with the big book. I don't like to be exclusive. I like to be inclusive. And I can't sponsor 24 women effectively. And I have 24 women in my big book study. So, you know, there aren't a lot of women that have 24 years of sobriety in Louisville that are still very active. So I don't want to separate myself and keep anybody from being able to pick my brain for a little bit of knowledge or wisdom that I might happen to have. I'm going to tell you 5 quick stories. Because the deal is, that's how I got sober. That's how I drank. But what it really matters is, how do we live sober? And how do we deal with life? And how do we deal with life when it just kicks our butt? You know, because you guys are like me. You're getting sober young. You know, that means your whole life. Okay, I'm 46 years old now. And I've stayed sober, you know, longer than I thought I was going to live, you know. And it's amazing. And it's like, the first, like really big deal that sort of happened to me was that in 1997, my grandmother died. And it was a great big giant deal, because my grandmother was my kind person when I was growing up. I didn't do much intimacy because I was, there wasn't a lot of it available. There wasn't a lot of consistency with anybody. And my grandmother was consistent. She was kind. She was loving. She helped me define my own spirituality. You know, a lot of times in AA, people say fear and faith cannot live in the same house. Well, I beg your pardon, because I'm afraid, and I have a lot of faith, and that's why I can still talk to you even though I am afraid. It's because I feed my faith instead of my fear. And my grandmother, she grew up in an era, this is just one example, where it was very popular to be prejudiced towards certain groups of people just because of the color they were born or something else. And my grandmother never said a negative word about one person or one group of people ever. She loved everybody. She loves the answer. What's the question? And what I learned from her is that if I feed fear, I see what's wrong in you and you and you, and I become negative and cynical. And to me, that's the opposite of spirituality. And when I feed faith, I see what's right in you and you and you and you, and I'm relatively happy. And to me, that's spirituality. And that's living spiritually. And that's when I get to pass the good news on. But that's my spirituality. That may not be what fits for you. So I learned that from my grandmother, who was the kindest person I ever knew. She's the only person I ever knew that went to church real regular. She'd come home with her little Bible. Never once was that thing used as a weapon. Never once. I mean, never once did she threaten me with it. Never once was it like, if you don't, you're gonna. None of that ever came out of her. Only love is the answer. What's the question? And so when she died in July of 1997, she was terrified, and it broke my heart. See, I didn't understand how when it came time for her to cross over that God could let this little angel be so afraid. And I got angry. And I took a walk in the dark sober. I was 11 years sober, and I got mad at God. And I said, God, if that's who you are, I don't believe in you. And not only that, I don't want nothing to do with you. Now, that's a hard place to be when your whole life depends on a spiritual connection. And I'll tell you what, it's the loneliest place I've ever been in my entire life. Having had a spiritual experience and then not being able to feel God. Now, I only did two things right. I went to meetings. You know how we get an AA image? Oh, I'm 3 years sober. I have to act like this. I'm 4 years sober. They must see me like this. Well, I was 11 years sober and a circuit speaker, and I went to meetings and cried and said, I'm so lonely, I can't feel God, and I'm not sure I believe in Him anymore. I told the truth. I was transparent. I was real. That was one thing I did right. The other thing I did right was I continued to search for God. I continued to look. If you're real, let me know. This went on from July of 97 till February of 1998. February 1, 1998. One of the things I bought myself in early recovery was a big old Harley Davidson. It was an old 79 FLH for those of you, and it was all customized, and all the guys were jealous of my bike. It was sweet, and had long, straight fishtail pipes on it. And I don't know about you guys, but when I got here, I vibrated. You know what I mean? I still kind of move a lot, but you know what I mean? Like, I couldn't sit still. You know, like, after your fifth step, you're supposed to sit still for an hour? Well, mine looked like this, you know? And so they wanted me to meditate. Well, I don't know if meditate includes smoking a lot of cigarettes, you know, bouncing around. And I can't ohm, you know, like, ohm, no way, man. I still can't ohm. Ohming is out, all right? So what I got was I got a Harley Davidson. You know what? It vibrated more than I did. Yes, it did. And then the wind would get in my hair, and guess what? I could feel God. God will meet me where I am. It took a Harley Davidson for me to learn to meditate. It did. But that was my first meditation tool. God will meet me where I am. And He met me on a Harley Davidson. And in the wind, I learned to meditate. So on February 1, 1998, it was unusually warm in Louisville, Kentucky. I got up on my Harley Davidson, and I was cruising on I-65, which is a major interstate. And I got on, I was doing about 65 or 70 miles an hour, and somebody came over my lane. That happens. I was going to go in the emergency lane, but it was blocked. And they were doing about 65 or 70 miles an hour. And anyway, they hit me. And according to police report, I was tossed 17 foot in the air. That's what happens when 70 miles an hour and 70 miles an hour hit. And I come down, and somebody's driving down the middle lane of the highway, and I land on the hood of that car. I roll off that car, and then that car drives up me. And my lungs were collapsed. My heart got shifted to the left. My face was ripped off. My eye was out. I'm laid in the center lane of the highway. I didn't know I'd already been drove over. I could see traffic coming. I thought, oh, I'm going to drive over. And then I realized that I'm not breathing, that blood's coming out of every orifice of me. And I realized I'm dying, because I was. And I got really afraid. Probably the most afraid I've ever been. Of course we're afraid to go to the other side. We're afraid to move across town. You know? So I probably was afraid like my grandma. And then this is, I love getting to share this, because the next thing that happened was I let go in the most absolute way that I've ever let go. And I got wrapped in love. White, billowy clouds of love. And I believe that God just wrapped me in His arms. And, you know, I've still got some scars left on my face. They've reconstructed it, and I went through many, many, many surgeries. And when I look in the mirror, and I've gained a lot of weight since then, there's a lot of other things that have happened. But instead of seeing ugly, I think, you know, you've been kissed on the cheek by God. And I wound up in trauma 9, and I wound up in the hospital, and I had a lot of problems. I have a traumatic brain injury, and afterwards I would read a book, and you heard about my little photographic memory. Well, by the time I read the bottom of the page, I couldn't remember what the top of the page said anymore, so I lost my ability to read. And I lost everything I owned, including my business. I went on food stamps and Social Security disability 12 years sober. I lost my face, which as a woman had been something I had relied on a lot. And I was in the hospital sometime, and then AA people took care of me. AA people showed up, and I had seizures. I had a spinal cord injury. I had to learn to walk again. And where's my value going to come from? I can't remember your name if I just met you. And they said, they brought me newcomers. They brought me new girls. That's about what I need. And they brought me new girls, and this new girl would come, and she'd say, they'd say, "Tell Cindy what you told us in the car on the way over." And she'd say, "Oh, no. No, no, tell Cindy what you told us in the car on the way over. No, tell Cindy what you told us on the way over. Way, way, Cindy. My boyfriend left. And I just don't know how I'm going to go on." I'd have a seizure. She'd feel so much better. Next time they bring another girl, "Tell Cindy what you told us on the way over." Hell no. "No, tell Cindy what you told us on the way over." "Well, Cindy, I stopped smoking crack, and I've gained 5 pounds, and I just don't feel good about how I look." And I'd say, "Oh, honey, I understand what it feels like to not feel good about how you look." And she'd feel better. Now, my short-term memory was so bad, all I knew, I wouldn't know what happened. All I knew is that when people came to my house, they felt bad, and when they left, they felt good. Something very magical happened. See, I was probably the most useful I've ever been having a seizure. That wasn't my vision for how I would be the most spiritual and the most useful to God. But God will use me where I am if I allow Him to. I am useful anywhere I am if I ask God to let me be. That has been my experience. Now, I went on from that, and nobody gave me a job, so I took one on straight commission, talked the guy into let me, talked him into let me work for him for no money. And and I became the number one technology salesperson in Louisville, Kentucky. Because I couldn't remember nothing I was selling. I just tell them, "I promise you that I'll make sure they do what they say." And they believed that I would do that. See, I just tried telling the truth. And I couldn't sell on my looks, and I couldn't sell on no hogwash. And at the time, people were selling a bunch of jargon when they sold technology, and I just sold the truth. And then they got bought, and I got a nice job again, and I was still having lots of surgeries. And then I got cancer, and it was really disappointing. And I was 34 when I had my wreck. I was 36 years old, and I got diagnosed with breast cancer, which is very young to be diagnosed with breast cancer. So don't let anybody tell you you're too young to have it, 36 years old or younger. And then they said it'd be early, if at all. It was in my lymph nodes. And I did a year of chemo and radiation. And but when I found out that was in my lymph nodes, I got afraid, and I got mad for a day. I kicked the back door off my house. And I said, "God, what do you want from me?" You know, I had a childhood that should have killed anybody. I've lived in institutions where most people are left to rot. I came off the streets that nobody makes it out of. You know, I have alcoholism and drug addiction, and I had a highway motorcycle accident that should have killed anybody. Now I have cancer, and just what do you want? And I paused when agitated or doubtful. And here's what I heard. "You had a childhood that should have killed anybody. You lived in institutions where most people are left to rot. You made it out of the streets where most people never make it out alive. You're recovering from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. You had a highway motorcycle accident that should have killed anybody, and now you have cancer and you're alive. And so in one moment, what went from feeling so terribly sorry for myself became something that made me feel so grateful. Because here I was at 36 years old with the wisdom of an old woman and the ability to help countless people because I was so rich in experience. And that's how I treated it. And we had a blast with my cancer. We shaved my head. We painted it at Soberfest. People babysat me while I threw up off the side of the bed. You know, you guys never left me. You never left me. We blew bubbles at chemo, and they were afraid that we were going to hurt ourselves. I'm like, I got cancer, man. I'd like to tell you that was it. And I'm going to finish these last two stories, and I'm going to shut up, so can, don't do the cards anymore, okay? Cause I think I'll do it in the right amount of time, but my little brain injury gets me all distracted. So I'd be walking along, and then I would fall and not be able to get up. And one of the things that happened in my childhood is I got kicked a lot through doors and stuff, you know, like drop kicked. And apparently my back was broken. And that's just life for a lot of us. It's just part of our lives. And I thought I had let that go, and I thought I had resolved that in my step work. But they had to cut my spinal cord, and I had to have a big deal surgery and put plates in my back and rods and screws and all kinds of stuff. And so when I woke up in the hospital after that surgery, it's very painful when they've opened up your central nervous system. And the slideshow of my childhood took over. Like every trauma that I'd ever taken to my back went click, 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 like you're looking through one of those viewfinders. And I called my sponsor and I said, I can't live like this. You know, I'm 17 years sober at the time. Like, I just can't live like this. And she said, we work on it when you get out. And what we work on it meant was we were going to work on forgiving my daddy. And we did a lot of forgiveness work. And the evidence that we did it is I went and made amends to him. And it's a real big deal because I wish I would have known it when I was earlier in my recovery, what freedom it brought. Because what I did was every time somebody would say something nice about him, I made sure when I was younger that they knew how not so nice he was and how much that he had hurt me. And I damaged his reputation intentionally. That was my part. I didn't have any part in what he did to me. But I went back to him and I said, Daddy, I was wrong and I harmed you. And I've damaged your reputation and I'm really sorry, and if there's anything else I can do to make this right, I'll be glad to. And if there's anything else I've done to harm you that I'm unaware of, I'll be happy to hear it now. And he did something that he's never done in his life. He's never admitted anything he ever did. He repeated my words. He said, my cousin had confronted him about the time we went camping when he beat me with an extension cord. And he said that he was really ashamed about that. And then he repeated my words, and he said, if there's anything else I've ever done to harm you you'd like to bring up, he'd be glad to listen to it. Well, lock and load, baby. I've been waiting my whole life. But here's what came out of my mouth. I said, Daddy, that was a long time ago, and I've forgiven you. And all that I would like is to go on and try to have as decent of a relationship as we can for the rest of our lives. That's the evidence that I forgave him. I didn't have to punish him. That's why before I go making amends, I have to have done my forgiveness. That's why I couldn't have done it till I was 17 years sober. I wasn't ready to do all that forgiveness. But the neat thing is, since I've done that, that slideshow has never been back. It's the most powerful thing in my life. I'm free. I'm a free woman. I'm not tormented. I'm not triggered by anything. I'm just free. And how neat is that? Then the last little deal that happened was 2 years later when I was 40. Because of a balance issue, because of my brain injury, I was showing, I have a Victorian house, and I was showing a contractor I was going to turn my attic into a master bedroom, but I slipped through the rafters and I fell and I broke my neck. And I was paralyzed from the chest down, and couldn't feed myself, couldn't walk, couldn't do nothing. And that was hard, because I didn't know if I was ever going to be able to do anything again, and I was frustrated, and I didn't even want you guys around. You know, I just was tired. And one of my friends said, "Cindy, we've shown up every time for you. We've helped you get up. You get your ass up for us this time." And you kept showing up anyway. And as you can see, I walk again and I feed myself. And I've done remarkable with God's help and your help. And all through all of this, because I believe that I've gone about the business of God's business, and I've stayed in the center of AA, and I've continued to sponsor women, and I've continued to have a sponsor, and I put AA ahead of everything else. I've still been a part of the community. I serve on several nonprofit board of directors. I mean, I'm like really a part of the community. I started a business at the end of breast cancer therapy, and I have the second largest interactive agency in our region, and we do really cool stuff. We build iPod apps. iPhone apps, and we build websites, we do online marketing, we build browser-based software, we do cool stuff, and I've got the coolest group of Y generation, XY generation folks that work for me. It's just a blast, and my life is a dream, and but what I know is I've lost everything before financially. I've lost everything that I exteriorly that I thought gave me value. And I know that I can still be happy, and I know that my value comes from right here. And I know that as long as I stay a part of AA, that I get to have a sense of meaning, and I get to be a part of you. And you're what gave me my life. And I'm so, so grateful for that. Thank you for inviting me to talk.
Hi, my name's Teresa, and I'm an alcoholic. And this is Dr. Bob's last message, delivered at the first international conference at Alcoholics Anonymous at Cleveland, Ohio in 1950. I get a big thrill out of looking over the vast sea of faces like this with the feeling that possibly some small thing I did a number of years ago played an infinitely small part in making these meetings this meeting possible. I also get quite a thrill when I think that we all had the same problem. We all did the same things. We all got the same results in proportion to our zeal and enthusiasm and stick-to-itiveness. If you will pardon the injection of a personal note at this time, let me say that I have been in bed 5 of the last 7 months and my strength has not returned as I would like. So my remarks of necessity will be very brief. But there are two or three things that have flashed into my mind on which would be fitting to lay a little emphasis. One is the simplicity of our program. Let's not louse it up with Freudian complexes and things that are interesting to the scientific mind, but have very little to do with our actual AA work. Our 12 steps, when simmered down to the last, resolve themselves into the words love and service. We understand what love is, and we understand what service is, so let's bear those two things in mind. Let us also remember to guard that erring member, the tongue. And if we must use it, let us use it with kindness and consideration and tolerance. One more thing. None of us would be here today if somebody hadn't taken the time to explain things to us, to give us a little pat on the back, to take us to a meeting or two, to have numerous little kind or thoughtful acts on our behalf. So let us never get the degree of smug complacency so that we're not willing to extend or attempt to that help which has been so beneficial to us. To our less fortunate brothers, thank you very much.